This podcast is part of the Big Heads Media Podcast Network. Go to bigheadsmedia.com for more great podcasts.
Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Sharita. How are you?
Not too bad.
Good.
We're gathered here in the foyer of the Salt Hill Hotel.
Is two people a gathering?
Indeed.
Hmm.
One crow is a crow, two is a potential murder.
Potential murder. And that's actually a question. Are three or more crows a murder?
Premeditated, because if they texted their friend crow to come and join them.
Oh yeah, it's the first text three. Circle. It's very big amongst crows.
I have a joke, actually.
Yeah.
I have a series of jokes. Did you hear about the magic tractor? It went down the road and it turned into a field.
Oh my good God. Although, that's probably not as bad as I had Sky TV on earlier this afternoon. And I was working on my laptop and Kay Burley was doing a segment called Is It a Rabbit or Is It a Raven? Now, this is a journalist on Sky TV. And there was somebody stroking a rabbit's or raven's head. And the public in the UK had to decide if it looked like a raven or looked like a rabbit. Now, that's not the worst of it, Sharita.
Oh, no.
Okay?
Okay.
This is a 2-minute segment, maybe 90 seconds, whatever.
A filler, yeah.
So, but then it was repeated.
No.
Every 10 minutes.
Did you ever find out?
I did find out.
Was it in fact
a raven.
Spoilers.
Spoiler alert. It was the most, and they do car crash news TV everywhere. We've seen it everywhere. They do it in
news reports of car
crashes.
Especially
in the US is quite known for it. You know, in New York, there's a cat up a tree in Queens. Coverage.
Live footage of a cat up a tree.
Yeah, whereas, there's something major happening in Europe and it's not covered, but this happens all the time and it's kind of fun. And, the Anchorman with the water skiing squirrel, like one of my favorite bits ever on celluloid. But this was particularly bad. And she kept coming back to, but look at it, is it a rabbit having its head scratched or is it in fact a raven? You should go back and look at it. I'm sure it's on YouTube by now.
Have we reached peak content?
Well,
have we reached peak
content?
About 10 years ago when we were watching people sleep live in Big Brother. And you know what reminds me of this? Hmm. There's a Jade Goody documentary out at the moment that a lot of people are talking about.
Yes.
And it's a lot of people are. Do you remember the time? And I forgot the time. And do you remember this happened? And do you remember that happened? And ultimately, I suppose, in the memory of people, Jay Goody would be remembered for the way that she died and how she left the world. Mm. But then when they go back and they look in their history, as this documentary is divulging, it brings back all the memories of reality TV in its genesis and what that meant and the ethics behind that. And I distinctly remember coming home from a nightclub and sitting down on a couch with a friend of mine who, much to my bemusement, had intentions that after 3 or 4 hours of sitting in silence watching some guy who was on Big Brother sleeping, it only occurred to me, why am I doing this? Why is this guy, why are we watching this on the TV? Oh my God, he fancies me. Like, we reached peak content quite some time ago to the extent that someone funded that lady to do the Is It a Rabbit or Is It a Raven?
It was very funny. But also, peak content is a very relative term nowadays. So that brings me nicely to
this week's documentary.
Love Island. Have you seen Love Island?
I got addicted to the first season.
No.
Only purely because of peer pressure from my work colleagues. And I did I did binge watch a load of episodes, and then I knew everything, and then by the time the finale came across, I was able to engage in water cooler conversation. It is not a thing I'm proud of. It's like that kind of Bewitched album that you have in your album.
No, it's not like that. It's worse,
American
Frida.
Listeners, you need to
find
out about
this. America.
Bewitched are this Irish band.
Bewitched
are this Irish band. Double Denim all the way, and they had a one-hit wonder. They would say, they would beg to differ, but I remember distinctly when I went over to America on the J1 and I played a Bewitched song, I remember the DJ go, "This is a cracking tune," you know, and all. Well, he didn't say that. He said something Americanism, like.
Oh, I'm getting some raspberry tea. Bewitched conversation.
But Bewitched, guilty pleasures are good. Dave Grohl says it's okay. Like, whatever music you like, there's no shame in liking music. That's what makes you who you are.
No, I agree. I watch Dr. Pimple Popper. So, yes, guilty pleasures are good. However, Love Island.
No, sorry.
She's my Halloween costume this year.
No, excuse me. You spent an extended amount of time talking about my fear of clowns. So well, I'm just going to take a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You've just discovered Dr. Pimple Popper.
I have. 3 episodes in. I'm hooked.
It's gross. Let's acknowledge that.
It's beautifully gross.
It's also the most fascinating thing on a gross level. It's like cysts and pimples and all this. Like, my personal thing at the minute is rescued dogs videos.
Oh no, I can't watch animals. They're too invested.
I prefer to watch animals being rescued from drastic situations, because you know there's going to be a good story in the end with these videos, to someone's cyst and the sack being removed.
That's fine.
And the extensive state of someone's back, and you know, I mean, Dr. Pimple Popper, fair play to her.
Yeah, but that's definitely a guilty pleasure. But now back to Love Island.
She's found a niche.
So Love Island is not... See, I have never seen it.
Yeah.
But a friend of mine who never watches and is actually allergic, breaks out in a rash when you talk about reality TV of any kind.
A friend
of mine is hooked on it. So I thought, oh my God, if he's really into it, maybe I should think about this. So I said it to somebody, and she said, don't do it, because if you start watching it, you have to watch all the episodes. So I thought, but there are, what, 6 episodes?
No. So it's like Big
it's
Brother.
22 or something episodes, something.
I don't
25?
Know.
A lot
I'm
of
thinking
hours
it's
of
in
your
the
life.
30s, to be fair.
Really?
But there's also a podcast, and there's also The Morning After. And like, you're rooting for couples, and then they mix it up where they have the Casa de some stuff, where they all go up and there's a load of fancy looking new women and fancy looking new men that tempt the eye of the couples or whatever. Do you know what? Casa de More, that's what it's called. It's like this, right? It did have a nice little beautifully placed cameo appearance in Orange is the New Black in the last season, which was fantastic. It does deserve its little moment, but no more in television history.
Well, I thought, out of interest, just because everyone I know is talking about it, I would watch the 6 episodes, but I'm not giving it 22 hours of my life or 40 hours of my life or whatever I would be investing in that amount of time.
But it's like the new Eurovision. The Irish are coming in and they're rocking up the joint. That's what it is. That's what makes it so fascinating. That's why this year, controversial.
It's brainless, ridiculous stuff. Which is, I think it's okay if it's 6 episodes. I think it's kind of cool. Or if it's 10 episodes, or if it's, you're dipping in and out. But I think if it's the kind of show that keeps you there, I can't argue with it. It's a global phenomenon. And the Irish person apparently has had international offers and all the rest. It might only last for 15 minutes.
There's a few Irish people.
Oh, I only heard about one.
There's a few. There's one very controversial
I'm
Irish lady.
Party, you know.
And then there's sorry. Well, no, I'm not going to say what I was going to say. Oh. There's a few international. there's a few very controversial Irish people who participated. this year. I think the guy who won it was from Limerick or something.
What?
But this is it. This is...
Okay. But are they on an island? Someone else said they're not even on an island.
It's not even... It's
misleading from the outset.
Is that the criticism that you have?
No, my criticism really is...
Did you not see the fire documentary?
Of 15 and 16-year-olds looking at fabricated, shallow people and idolising them.
Do you know what?
But that's all of YouTube.
So you have a problem with 15 and 16-year-olds watching fabricated material.
I feel for my friend's children. And so I'm coming from that perspective.
Idolising them.
From the point of view of being a 15 or 16-year-old, or even remembering what that was like, because thankfully I do not.
So
I just care about my friends who are parents who are concerned about their kids watching this. So that's where I'm coming from.
But you're coming from the point of view that your concern is manipulation by what they watch.
Well, no, I've no... I see where you're going with
yes,
that.
Because that's the topic of this week's documentary, very much so. The Great Hack,
well,
2019.
Being fed information.
And our reality, our individual reality, is completely impacted by what we see in the TV or social media. And this is where this is coming from.
It is. That's a very nice segue there, Sharita.
I like
what you did there.
I'm telling you now. So this documentary, The Great Hack, deals primarily with data mining and its implications for democracy. It deals with a company called Cambridge Analytica. They're based in the UK. And how it gleans information from social platforms and various different social companies and sells it on to companies for various different ends. And it's fascinating.
It totally is. I mean, I'm not jumping ahead, because this is the crux of the whole thing, is that they say that data is the hottest, most expensive commodity in the market at the moment.
It's
so
surpassed
it used to
oil.
Be oil.
Yeah.
And now it is data.
Yeah.
So now I also question, you know, the validity of that, because I think anything that's virtual or online, or you're relying on companies to produce numbers, could go, you can always fabricate. But I have to say, I do think that that's probably the case, because people, when we see the examples of how it played out, data is probably the most valuable commodity in the world. It can be used to do anything.
Already, what strikes me about this is that this talk of value, and for me this documentary is an awful lot about value versus cost. We know the value of a company, we know the value of what a tech giant does, and we know how much money they make, what the capital earning is for this company, what the profit is that they take away. But the question of this documentary is, what's the cost? What's the cost to online privacy?
Yeah, no, definitely. First of all, if you're buying data, you're only buying the data from a clinical perspective. You're only buying the data as a corporation if you feel it can translate to sales. So it's, what are the dollar signs, what are the euro signs when you translate that data into valuable sales dollars? Like, that's, at the end of the day, that's all we're worth. They don't care about us as human beings. But the scary thing was when they said they had 5,000 data points on every single individual voter in the United States. So just to break that down, that's 5,000 data points about, say, for you, for instance. So it would be that you're female, you live in Oklahoma, you have a dog called Charlie, you like animals, you work in this particular job, these are your aspirations. You belong to the tennis club, the football club, the blah, blah, blah. They had 5,000 pieces of information on every single person who was registered to vote in the United States.
That's just frightening.
Isn't it?
Yeah. It's frightening on a number of things. From a human rights perspective, I say human rights respect. I'm very aware of the fact that there is no human rights that covers online privacy, right? But there is a kind of a moral implication that it's not okay for you to take my personal information without my consent. So how do they gain my consent? And very thinly, this is a complicated documentary, but very thinly weaved into it would be the inference that you're up on Facebook and you offer information about yourself freely on Facebook, and if you click on an app, then you accept the terms and conditions, and you do a psychological survey online, you click whatever points, find out what your IQ is, and do a psychological survey, and your personality survey details are taken.
Yeah.
There is, at one point in this documentary, somebody says it wasn't just in one app, and some of the apps would not just look at your data that you offered freely, but some of the apps would look at those of your friends. That's one point of information. The second point of information, which just occurred while we're sitting here in this hotel foyer, is that when I joined into the Wi-Fi here, they asked me to accept the terms and conditions, and I freely clicked the box and didn't read the terms and conditions. And the second point was that they asked me to add, you can either create your own profile or you can add your Facebook account and you can continue on. So I'm linking the fact that I'm in this hotel with my Facebook account, and therefore there must be some privileges that are linked to the fact that my account and all the information that's on it are linked to this hotel. And I found, by the casual way that I did that, and then thinking about it in the context of this documentary, that it is very insidious how this information can be mined.
I know, totally. And I think it's important to kind of give a few examples of those quizzes, because people don't realize. We are a little bit stupid. You know, we are playing on our phones and we see, what celebrity do you most resemble? And you click on it thinking, this is fun. And this is a great way to get me engaged in this. And then you click on it, you hear it, you know, they give you do you accept the terms and conditions? And you click yes. Now, not in doing that, you can be clicking yes, take all of my information, and you don't realize it, which is bad enough. But also buried deep in the terms and conditions could be, I give you permission to take all of my friends' information.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a greater responsibility here, where we need to be responsible for our friends' security. Should we be the access, the gateway to all of our friends' information?
Oh yeah, that's different from what you said initially. Yeah, it's like, should we be, is the question.
It's a two-step process.
Yeah.
You really are ultimately responsible for your own data. It's where it shouldn't be presented to you in a cloak and dagger manner. Whereas that's exactly how it's presented. So, you know, what's your IQ? What friend most resembles you? which friend do you most interact with? All of that stuff is, they're traps. And we walk into them.
Yeah.
But I think until this documentary, nobody really realized that. Or very few realized that.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm also Chris.
And together we do a comedy podcast called Cooking with Grief.
Each week we dive into four surprising facts about anything from science to history to the weird world we live in, making jokes about all of it as we go along.
You can find us on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And you can also find us on Twitter at Cooking with Grief. No G on cooking.
Glitter, apparently, is so unique that it can be effectively used as forensic evidence.
The Bank of England's chief economist has urged to start using people's Spotify playlists as a way of measuring the economy.
In China, Avengers has been translated as Fulian, or Women's Federation.
Not only did the Russians capture the Crimean Peninsula, they also captured some Ukrainian military dolphins.
In Pinocchio, and the film becomes a real boy. In the original, it ends with a cat and a fox hanging him from a tree.
Scientists have wiped a snail's memory.
And Slytherin's going, can we have an extensive series of tunnels, sort of wide enough to fit a giant people-killing snake?
Where do you fall on the scone-scone debate?
Scone, obviously.
Oh, I I will scold.
So, what have you got to lose? Give us a try.
Nothing to lose but your sweet, precious time.
Yeah, that's true.
The other thing that struck me about this is that in order to make restrictions or regulations about this, that says that if you operate in this country, then you have to allow people to opt out. You have to put the onus on the social media provider to ensure that they don't just click terms and conditions, that it is explicitly, without any shadow of a doubt, actually articulated that if you accept this, we have access to this, this and this. That requires a government in a state to make law. And these are companies that are multinational and that sometimes they can operate in states where the legal framework is not yet in place. And then in other states, it is. So they can't operate there, or they can modify to get around the law in those. Because these multinational companies, the tech giants as they're called, you know, they can say, okay, well, the onus is on the person. If they make it public, then we can do this. And that's the way it is. And in this state, we can't do this. And in this state, we can't do that. And this state. And that puts the onus on us to try and defend ourselves against technology, which is forming at a quicker rate than the states can legislate against it. We've seen this in cyberbullying. And this is the greatest form of cyberbullying, in my opinion.
Well, it's the greatest form of invasion, but certainly this has been the case since, this is not a new topic, like since the beginning of the internet, interweb, the online community has been changing, and online law, which is outside of legislative law, has changed much faster than legislation can ever keep up with. It changes on a daily basis. Like YouTube changes on a daily basis. Yeah. Google changes on a daily basis. Facebook changes. They reinvent themselves overnight, in hours, in a minute.
When they want to.
But also they can. Because who's going to catch them? You know, how fast can the laws keep up? Even if the laws come into effect today to stop this from happening, they'll invent a new way to do it.
Yeah.
So I think that's what we're up against. It's an ever-changing world, and it's not going to stop. The acceleration of change is not slowing down. It's only accelerating.
Yeah.
Which is a scary thought. But then what do we learn from that? I think that they make the point in the documentary that data rights are human rights. Because I think we have to start thinking like that. Instead of thinking about our traditional human rights, this is a major human right that when exploited can devastate economies, political systems, everything.
Certainly, if you were to believe this documentary, it has implications for democracy as we see it.
But you
as we idealise it. And
would
I 100%...
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, I
no,
didn't.
No, you know what it is? It's like, there are a lot of problems with the way that different states run their democracy, and there's problems with the Irish electoral system, there's problems with the English electoral system, in my opinion, clearly. There's problems with the US electoral system. This is just merely highlighting one of the many problems. One of the key things that I found interesting about this particular documentary was the way that some of the key figures were portrayed within its narrative. Like the journalist, for example, Carol Cadwallader, and
she's
also
great.
Yeah, and Brittany Kaiser.
She was interesting.
Well, this is the thing. It's like, depending on what way you fall in the political spectrum, you have an opportunity within this documentary to look at these women and their personal traits and decide what you think either way.
It was really interesting.
So that's what makes this documentary for me. And, you know, I mean, clearly, because it has this message of this practice is wrong. It's not shying away from that. This documentary is saying that the great hack is fundamentally that we can glean information from people's social media profiles, that can be gleaned into data points. Those data points can build a profile about a person, and from that you can gather some behavioural aspects, and from that you can gather how they may vote, and out of that information you can target people on their social profiles and bombard them with content, propaganda, for whatever way you want to vote. And the documentary gives loads of examples, a lot of them in developing countries, but more interestingly, and this is why they made this documentary, there's implications that this technique may have been used by Cambridge Analytica in the Trump campaign in the presidential election and also in the Brexit campaign.
I would say there's very little uncertainty there. I mean, they say pretty much, and Steve Bannon was a VP of Cambridge Analytica. So I don't think there's much doubt as to whether it was used, and Brexit also. But the scariest example in the whole documentary for me, and gosh, this is saying something, was the Do So campaign in Trinidad and Tobago.
Yeah.
Now, not interesting in that they targeted Trinidad and Tobago, but also, but the main thing for me, it was in 2013, very scary that they fostered apathy as a weapon. So they encouraged people to be empowered by not voting. So they took away their power by empowering them, in inverted commas. And they targeted that market, and everybody stopped voting. And I thought, oh gee, I mean, that is scary, because that's possible. They can get into your homes, and they can just say, just don't vote. But that's a prime example of it. It's not the only example of it. I'm just saying, in this documentary, that was one of the scariest moments for me.
100% agree with you. It was terrifying to see. It's a very personal thing when you look at your social feed on
you
Facebook.
You think it is.
And you feel that it's representative of the news entirely. And this is a representation of society and how people are thinking. It's not. It's an algorithm that says, this is the stuff that you want to see. So we're giving you more of the stuff that you want to see. So it's reaffirming your articulated beliefs through an algorithm and your predictive behaviour through an algorithm. So if they want to change your opinion, they flood your newsfeed with stuff that's going to persuade you to vote one way or another. And that's exactly what they did in this developing country.
The thing with the Trinidad and Tobago example is that it's a very, very clear example. It's a laid out campaign. We could see it happening. We saw it, and the footage is exactly, it's exactly as they planned it. And you can see the puppet masters, and you can see the evidence of it. And it worked. And that, for me, was scary.
It was terrifying, and I agree. It is terrifying.
Yeah, even near
past. Yeah, oh no, but this
like,
is...
That was 2013. When you think about that, what have they done since then that we don't know about?
There's a whole segment in it about SCL, which originally were a military company, and about their implications and their use of technology. And they have like stuff in developing countries way back into the 90s. Kenya, for example, and South Africa, and all this stuff. And it seemed as if the implications of what SCL did and their involvement in elections is a lot more sinister. You know, and I do agree with you. I'm just saying that the process of trying to manipulate voters is there. And this whole documentary for me is about, is it right or is it wrong? Or as one of the guys said, are you cheating? You know, when they asked him, well, do you think it had any impact at all on the eventual outcome? And he turns around and he says, listen, when someone's doping at the Olympics, they don't turn around and say, sure, 'tis grand. You were going to win the medal anyway. That's what we're asking now. And then later on, someone said, is this partisan? Are you bringing this up because you think that you don't like the results of their election? And Carol turned around, the journalist, and she said, sure, this is something that affects all of us. Democracy cannot. The electoral laws that are there at the moment are not fit for purpose because they can't defend us against the technology that's there. I thought that's the crux of the whole documentary.
Well, I mean, for me, the crux of the whole thing is, will we ever have a free and fair election again? And the answer is no, we won't. So no, unless everyone in the world educates themselves about this, and like, that's not going to happen. I mean, I look at my dad, I love my dad, but you know, he doesn't even know he's being marketed to.
Of course he doesn't. Yeah,
most people don't know. Well, we don't know. I'm sure we've been marketed to and we don't even know. Have you been hacked ever? Really?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
I have
you really?
Yeah, I was in a hotel room in Dublin. During the hurricane that didn't happen a couple of years ago, we were told that this big hurricane was going to hit Ireland, and it didn't.
Which one?
So I didn't, I don't know what it was called, but it never happened, so that's probably why I can't remember. But we were told not to travel, don't get on the roads, you can't be guaranteed that you'll, if you get on the bus in Dublin or the train, you can't be guaranteed they'll get you to go, like it was one of those. So I was staying in the lovely Morgan Hotel in Dublin. And they said because of the hurricane, if you just stay overnight, you can have the same lovely room for the same low price. So I stayed and had a great time. That's another story. I was accessing, I went online via the Morgan Hotel website. It's not their fault, but it was hacked. So I'm just doing my business, doing lots of business, lots of work in the lobby, then relaxed for the night. And then my phone beeped. And it was my friend Julianne in England. And she said, are you okay? Are you all right? Is there something wrong? Or I just got a text from you, a message from you on Facebook saying that you need money and that you're stuck in the hurricane.
No way.
And I said, I'm fine. And she said, oh my God, I'll phone you. So she phoned me and said, are you okay? I said, I'm fine. What did you get? She said, I'll send you the message now, but it came from your account. It said, hi, Julianne. I really need you to help me out. I'm stuck in Dublin with the hurricane and I just need €50. Will you just text this number and it'll be deposited into my account? And she said, I knew you would have phoned me. And I said, okay, thanks for calling. Next call is from my brother to say, did you get the money?
No.
Yes. I said, don't tell me you transferred. He got the same message on Facebook.
Can I just say,
€50.
I love the Morgan Hotel. I feel so sorry.
I know it wasn't their fault. It's obviously a hacker.
Yeah.
But So my brother was definitely taken. I don't know who else gave money.
Jeez.
But I put out a message right away and said, if anyone got a message from me, it's not me. Blah blah blah. And then Julianne sent me the screenshot, so I reported it. But the message that it came in from was exactly my profile, exactly my profile picture. It looked like it came from my account. And shortly thereafter, I got a friend request from my dad, and I'm already friends with him.
Okay.
So they could fake. They obviously hacked my account somehow, and then got into everything. It's very scary.
It is. It is very scary. And I can't wait to tell you what my recommendation of if you like this,
oh,
then
yes.
You like. But there's one moment in this,
yeah,
where Brittany Kaiser, because you can make up your own mind about her.
Mm.
You just don't know. You can only glean on the information that she's providing mm-hmm. to you, and she's very aware of that. So what she talks about at one moment is like, I feel like I was getting to know people that I disagreed with a lot. So she talks about when she first started the contract. Her opinions differed from the company that she was working with, and she had to morph into somebody who was more conservative, dressed more conservatively. She went shooting at the weekends. She got her gun license, things like that. And she says that, I feel like I was getting to know people that I disagreed with a lot. She remembers a lot. She mentions a lot of her family members. Then she says something that's primarily very interesting. She says, people are so polarized in the US, right? People are so polarized that they can't understand each other, and therefore they can't work together, and therefore nothing gets done. So her motivation for getting involved with something like the notion of data mining and using data as part of a campaign is to actually get bills passed, to get something done, even though it went against her own personal conviction. She just wanted to see, she went away from her background in human rights, she wanted to see results for the work that she was doing. Human rights, because of the fact that it's aspirational, takes years for social change to develop from a real fundamental point of view. She articulates in this document that, and she says this in the documentary, it's not my personal opinion, that Steve Bannon would have advocated that the only way to evoke social change is to destroy the society by taking apart traditional elements that are there and then rebuilding it in the form that you want it to be built in. The UK leaving the EU and Trump being elected, they're all things that were very unexpected. But the evolution of data analytics in the use of the campaigning seems to me to be something that is fundamentally polarised against human rights. It seems to be a very ultimately capitalist. You're making personal data a commodity versus socially, in terms of democracy, it's supposed to work this way. You're voting what you feel is right.
I know, but those days are gone. And like for her to say, you know, they're so polarised that nothing will ever get done, that's an old, old, old point of view. She's not saying anything new there. I think that really for her, she was interesting in that she told her story. She didn't have to tell her story, but she was telling it in the way that she wanted to tell it from a hotel in Thailand or whatever. It was interesting, though, to hear her point of view. And it was interesting for me to see all the other men, including Alexander Nix and all the rest, talk about how, oh, she was, you know, on our side and now she's not, and she was in the room. And there was a bit of patronizing stuff there. I mean, everything has changed. The world has changed. So, and for her to shift from, you know, human rights over to this, she was talking from a perspective of goals and lobbies and getting things passed, because that's a shift from public sector to private sector. So she was going to a corporate, and corporate are all about goals. Corporate are all about markers, achievements, you know, logging their achievements for the client and saying, this is what we achieved, now we're sending an invoice. So she went into the corporate world, which is, it's actually a great place to see for a brief period of time. I've seen it myself. I don't think it's the best place to live for me, but I admire everybody who works in different spheres. But you could see the shift in speak when she started talking about it. She started articulating in a corporate manner.
She did.
Yeah, which was interesting to see, I thought. And I know I said interesting at the beginning. I didn't mean that in a bad way. I thought it was very interesting to hear everything she had to say.
I thought she was fascinating.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Because she's a very strong, intellectual, articulate woman. And she's considered, you know, either she's a mastermind or she's somebody who's just bumbling around. But it was interesting, as you say, for the male characters in this documentary to say, oh, she's my friend, they betrayed me, the woman, the betrayer. Whereas actually, they're all betrayers.
Well, they're all out for themselves.
Yeah. So your man, Alexander Nix, is like, I'm the victim.
But it was, for me, the documentary is fine. It is what it is. It said more about what we owe ourselves in terms of protecting ourselves from exposure to data mining, and being a little bit smarter about how we interact online without going crazy. But I think we kind of need to be really, really careful. And, you know, every time we log on to Facebook, and every time we log on to Twitter, and every time we log on to a random website, we need to really think about what access we're giving and not be fooled into, I'll just tick this box. We all do it. But it has far-reaching implications now. And not only for us, that was the major thing for me. It's not only for us, it's for everyone we're connected with. It's everyone in your email contact list. Everyone in your email contact list. It's everyone in your address book. It's everyone in your phone text book. It's everyone in your WhatsApp groups.
For me, democracy, if you really want to defend it, is about you taking responsibility for finding out exactly what you're voting on and gleaning the knowledge. Don't do it on social media. Check a number of different sources. You cannot believe what you read in the papers. You cannot believe what's on your newsfeed on Facebook. Unfortunately, the newspaper in print is dying away, and there are some newspapers that are only available online at this point, and that's only going to continue. That means that your news sources are either on the television or on an algorithm predicted by Google or an algorithm predicted by Facebook or an algorithm predicted by Instagram or other giants like WhatsApp or whatever, whatever it is, you know what I mean? It's like on social, basically.
Or a verified news source of your choosing.
Yes, exactly.
So, and I had a six-month-only stint in a newsroom in iRadio, but I was on the news desk, and we were told that even if something major breaks, some or anything happens, and you hear it and you see it on a news website, and it's a trusted news website, you do not mention it on radio during the news bulletin unless you verified it from a separate, second, independent news source that you trust. And that was way back, that's 15 years ago. And the same is true now. You just have to find two news sources that you trust and you check everything. So it's about being informed and being smart.
Yeah, and there's always going to be, if there's a major election or a referendum, there's always going to be some availability of lecture series or stuff from your local university that will give you a breakdown of just what the fact is, what the facts are in terms of what your vote means or what the breakdown is in terms of this, that and the other. Don't listen to what your daddy voted in the last election. Your responsibility as a citizen is to get informed. In my opinion, if you don't become involved in politics, if you are not educated, if you don't educate yourself in what it means to vote yes or no, or for this guy or that guy, then all you're doing is assigning your power over to someone else. Do register to vote and do vote educated. Apathy is the greatest weapon. And the second greatest weapon is this crack that we're talking about now, data analytics and targeted voting, where misinformation will persuade you in your vote.
Well, I think if you think you're being marketed to and you think you're being targeted, you are. If you don't think you're being targeted, you still are.
You definitely are.
Yeah.
You definitely are. If you like this, then I think you might like the feature documentary called Identity Theft that stars Sandra Bullock, because when I originally watched this, it was the most conspiracy theory. This is ridiculous. Who the hell would ever be doing this? And if you watch it now, it comes across as pure naive, like that girl doesn't know half the stuff. I mean, this documentary, The Great Hack, is time sensitive. You might watch this in 3 years' time. We're going to find out some other crap and we're going to be like, this is mild in comparison to what
completely.
We have.
Oh, completely. Absolutely, yeah. That's the case.
And the other one I have is Citizen 4. And in particular, the moment that the phone rings in Citizen 4. I mean, this documentary will either have you off Facebook and just... It's just fascinating to me. It really is. There's so many twists and turns. This is a docs that rock for me.
It totally... And I would say there's only one documentary to watch, and that's The Brink.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Steve Bannon.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the next... You just watch it. And that's then it. Try and sleep at night.
Ooh. And hope that nobody's like capturing you sleeping on your camera on your phone.
There's no point. It's just, it's too late now.
Because you ask somebody, well, what's my face going to look like when I'm 30? And now your face is in facial recognition technology.
Well, you know, they say in this that do you often think that someone has overheard your conversation because then you're being marketed to?
The very beginning of this documentary.
Yeah, they say no, they're not listening to your conversation. They actually just know what you're going to do. We're that predictable. So what are we going to do right now, Sharita? I think raspberry tea.
I'm just going to look at my Facebook and see if they've picked up that I was thinking about ordering a sofa yet.
Well, they're going to say, would you like some raspberry tea? I would say.
Do you remember we did a documentary around Halloween and we were talking about Jamaica and then you got a prank call from Jamaica?
Yeah, my God. Maybe they are listening.
Hope nobody has an investigation. Yeah. We've got proof we recorded this in 2000 and whatever.
Oh, my God. So I think that's it for this week, Sharita. What do you think? Mm-hmm. That's it for Docs That Rock.
That's it for Docs That Rock.
Turning off all of my devices.
Yeah. You won't be hearing from us again.
No. Okay, well, good luck, listeners. That's it, and we'll be back next week with a new episode of Docs That Rock. I'm Tracy Ferguson.
I'm Sharita Darcy.
Goodbye.
See you.